An Israeli court denies a request to release a Palestinian inmate who has been on hunger strike for almost 80 days in the regime's prison. Tensions escalate in the disputed Karabakh region after Azerbaijan sets up a checkpoint on the only land route connecting the enclave to Armenia. Also ahead, Moscow warns that if the Group of Seven countries ban exports to Russia, it will respond by terminating the Black Sea deal that enables vital exports of grain from Ukraine. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, an Israeli court has rejected a plea to release a Palestinian hunger-striking inmate Sheikh Khader Adnan, despite repeated warnings about his serious health condition. Adnan's lawyer said an Israeli military court rejected his release on bail after nearly 80 days of hunger strike. The Palestinian Prisoner Society says the 45-year-old lost consciousness several times during the court session due to his worsening health condition. It says Adnan, who was attending the session via video conference, had also been unable to communicate with his family. The group has warned that the prisoner is at risk of losing his life. Palestinian rights groups say nearly 5,000 Palestinians, including women and children, are held in Israeli jails. Many Palestinians are incarcerated under the so-called administrative detention, a policy the regime pursues to keep Palestinians without charge or trial for an indefinite period. Iran has categorically dismissed U.S. accusations about the country's destabilizing role in the region. Tehran says Washington seeks to create Iranophobia and division in the region. Earlier, we took a closer look at the motive behind the U.S. allegations and the validity of Iran's response. Here's what our guests had to say.
Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, Tehran has reacted angrily to recent anti-Iran comments by the top American diplomat, and it says that Washington is once again fueling Iranophobia and division in the region. Foreign Ministry spokesman was referring to Antony Blinken, who accused Iran of destabilizing behavior and said that the U.S. remains committed to disrupting Iran's military procurement activities. Nasser Kanani called the U.S. State Secretary's remarks provocative, adding that their sole purpose is to create discord in the region in order to sell American weapons. He noted that Iran's military program is purely for defensive purposes. Kanani also underlined that Iran had always been in favor of regional security dialogue, and that is what led to what he called a recent positive cooperation, including with Saudi Arabia. He said that it is the wrong policy of the U.S. that brought insecurity and wars to the region. To discuss that further, we're joined by Mohammad Ali Araki, journalist and political analyst from London. Also, we have with us John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst from Belgrade. Thanks to both of you gentlemen for joining us on this edition of the News Review. Let's begin with Mr. Araki. Well, you heard the comments from Antony Blinken. Were you shocked to hear these comments? Let's consider also the timing, the rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Yes, so in terms of being shocked, no, I'm not shocked, because that's the job of America, to say provocative words, to cause friction in the region, to try to cause friction in the region. The United States of America no longer has a previous position that they had to cause the trouble and friction that they used to cause once upon a time in Western Asia. And also, I'd like to mention that the United States accused Iran of interference and all the other accusations that they recently made. I'd like to make something clear over here, and that is the fact that it is the United States of America that has had constant interference in Asia, especially Western Asia.
Mr. Bosnich, the foreign ministry spokesman, Nasser Kanani, did not mince his words. He said that the U.S. is basically trying to create discord in the region in order to sell American weapons. How much do you agree?
I couldn't agree more. As a Canadian citizen, I can tell you that America has a primary incentive to sell weapons to drive its own economy, which is not competing properly on the world scale. America is losing its economic power to China, and America's compensation for that is to push further and bigger wars around the world. They are not just doing this against Iran, they are doing this in Ukraine, pumping hundreds of billions of dollars in weapons into the region, for which they will indebt the Ukrainian people for generations.
In terms of the relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and basically Iran and the countries in the region, how much do you think such comments by Antony Blinken would actually be effective?
The comment by Antony Blinken, technically, it would cause a minor fear in those countries, because they're becoming brave now. They're realizing that they are understanding, and America is starting to realize that any decision, any action they wish to take in Western Asia, they have to involve Iran. What I mean by this is they have to seek the advice. Iran has to know. If Iran does not accept it, that will not go forward. As an example, you can witness the situation in Yemen. Okay, why did the war end? So that's as a result of a crime happening there, people being killed, and so then it went down towards the war being ended. So this will cause a minor fear in the region, in the heart of those countries. But generally, I believe that we're going on a very positive direction. And this direction is the United States of America, as other leaders of resistance said, they'd have to close their suitcases and they'd have to leave the region. So at the start, some may fear, there may be fear, there may be different reactions from other countries, but hopefully I'm positive about this. It will not stop relations being fixed, and we'll hopefully have a peaceful Middle East very soon, hopefully.
So Mr. Bosnich, Mr. Araki believes that the countries in the region are more vigilant now than before, and basically, in your opinion, let's look at this entire situation in light of the rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and of course, the reopening of embassies, closer relations, obviously economic relations are also on top of the agenda. How do you see this entire situation unfold?
Well, I think that this is a major rapprochement in Saudi Arabia and Iran, but it is also a massive loss of weapons sales potentially to the United States in Saudi Arabia. The idea that they can no longer play Saudi Arabia against Iran is going to rob the U.S. economy of billions and billions of dollars. And the important role played here in on the part of China to bring the two parties to the table and to begin the rapprochement has directly impacted the economy of the United States. The United States has come to the point where it is no longer competitive in the production business. China is outpacing them, outperforming them, and doing so at a much, much lower cost. Now we're going to see the collapse of the American military weapons-based business in the area. The only current major buyer is Israel. And that is the one last problem that has to be stopped in the region, and that is the American provocation of aggression on the part of Israel.
And do you agree with Mr. Araki that the countries in the region are more vigilant now?
This is evident to me here in Europe, and certainly evident to my colleagues who are still in Washington, where I worked in the past.
Thank you very much, Mr. John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst, joining us live from Belgrade. Mohamed Ali Araki, journalist and political analyst from London. Thanks for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of the News Review.
Moving on, tensions are once again flaring up on the border between Azerbaijan and Armenia. Both sides accuse each other of provoking a shootout after Azerbaijan set up a checkpoint on Armenia's only land route to the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. Azerbaijan says it wants to stop Armenia using the road to transport weapons. Armenia, meanwhile, says the checkpoint in the Lachin corridor is a gross violation of a ceasefire agreement which ended the 2020 war. Meanwhile, Baku and Yerevan both denied each other's claims of cross-border fire. Armenia said one of its forces was killed in the shooting. Nagorno-Karabakh is internationally recognized as part of Azerbaijan, but its inhabitants are predominantly ethnic Armenians, and it broke away from Baku in a war in the early 1990s. Russia is warning that it will terminate the Black Sea grain deal if the G7 bans exports to the country. Deputy Chairman of Russia's Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, says Moscow will also ban many other things that the G7 member states might need. The group of seven economic powers is reportedly considering a near total ban on exports to Russia. The Black Sea deal enables exports of grain from Ukraine. The deal brokered by the UN and Turkey was signed last July. The G7 on Sunday called for the extension of the deal, which expires next month. Moscow has repeatedly threatened to scrap its participation in the grain deal if the West does not lift restrictions on Russian agricultural and fertilizer exports. Moscow lashes out at Washington for refusing U.S. visas to Russian journalists seeking to enter the country for a visit to the United Nations headquarters. The Russian foreign minister said his country would not forgive the U.S., calling the move a stupid failure. Sergei Lavrov said denying visas to journalists was evidence of Washington's empty promise to respect freedom of speech. The move has drawn condemnations from other Russian officials, including Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov, who even warned of retaliation. Russia's UN mission also said that the move is a breach of Washington's obligations under the UN Headquarters Agreement. In response, the US State Department defended its obligations but failed to specify the reasons. Relations between the two countries have soured further since the war in Ukraine. Last month, an American journalist was arrested in Russia over espionage charges. Europe's annual military spending has reached its highest level since the end of the Cold War. That's according to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. The SIPRI said that the increase in the continent's expenditure on armament also contributed to a rise in global military spending, which stood at $2.24 trillion in 2022. According to the Institute, the Russia-Ukraine war played a major role in the rise. SIPRI reported that Ukraine's military spending alone rose over 600% last year. That doesn't include the vast amounts of military aid provided to Kiev by the West. The ongoing war has prompted many European countries to allocate more money for buying weapons and defense equipment. The United States, the biggest supplier of weapons to Ukraine, accounted for around 40% of global military expenditure in 2022. South Koreans have been protesting against the U.S. missile base south of the capital, Seoul. They want the base and the U.S. troops gone, as tensions grow with the North on the Korean Peninsula. Frank Smith reports from Seongju in South Korea.
Peace activists and local leaders in South Korea opposed to a U.S. anti-ballistic missile base have been demonstrating outside the presidential office in Seoul. The system known as Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD, was deployed in early 2017. U.S. officials say it protects against missiles fired from North Korea. Local residents argue it generates warlike tension and want it removed.
In fact, it is hard to fight against THAAD every day while farming. And on the other hand, the issue of THAAD is an urgent problem for those in Sosong and Gimcheon. It is directly related to the issue of peace and stability of the entire country.
Anti-THAAD protesters have held a rally near the base in Seongju, 250 kilometers south of Seoul. The government has indicated it would make the base permanent, and President Yoon Suk-yeol has suggested the country may get a second THAAD system. These villagers recognize that hosting a missile base makes their home a prime first target, not only for North Korea, but also for China, as THAAD's radar reaches in to Chinese territory. The THAAD base occupies a former mountain golf course and is near a Won Buddhist temple, whose monks also oppose the missile base.
THAAD should be eliminated as soon as possible, and the Korean Peninsula should be demilitarized in a broad sense.
Protests have disturbed the operation of the base with occasional blockades, as recent U.S.-South Korean military discussions suggested routine and unfettered access had been lacking. Frank Smith, Seongju, South Korea.
A diplomatic spat simmers between Beijing and Seoul as China slams what it calls erroneous remarks by the South Korean president about Taiwan. A Chinese vice foreign minister made a solemn representation to the South Korean ambassador over Yoon Suk-yeol's comments. According to the Chinese Foreign Ministry, the official conveyed Beijing's strong dissatisfaction over Yoon's totally unacceptable remarks. Earlier this month, Yoon called tensions between China and Taiwan a global issue similar to North Korea and blamed recent heightened tensions on attempts to change the status quo by force. China claims Taiwan as its own territory and insists that its dealings with Taipei are purely internal matters. That wraps up World News for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. After collapse of two major U.S. banks and record capital outflows from smaller lending banks, America's banking industry, which was worried about a banking crisis, is now worried about economic growth. Economic experts say that the recent pressures in the banking sector and the possibility of destroying their credit in the next stage will bring America closer to recession. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Cable news network CNN has covered the story and tells us more. According to notes from the Federal Reserve's March policy meeting released, the fallout from the recent banking crisis is likely to push the U.S. economy into a mild recession later on this year. Since November of 2022, economists at the Federal Reserve have predicted subdued growth and a weakening economy during policy decision meetings. In March, they said the banking crisis heightened the forecast for a recession. Minutes from the U.S. Federal Reserve's most recent two-day monetary policy meeting on 21st and 22nd of March noted, taking into account the potential economic effects of the recent banking sector developments, U.S. Federal Reserve economists' projection at the time of the March meeting included a mild recession starting later on this year. This is the first time in the current hiking cycle that staff economists have forecast such a recession. Nancy Davis, founder of the Quadratic Capital Management, in a note recently said, "The main takeaway from Wednesday's 12th of April Federal Reserve minutes is that the central bank anticipates a mild recession in late 2023 and that the soft landing window seems to be closing quickly." According to the minutes, policymakers at the U.S. Federal Reserve voted unanimously recently for a smaller interest rate increase after turbulence in the banking industry set off fears of bank runs. The notes released on Wednesday afternoon, 12th of April, highlighted the uncertainty behind the decision, which came just days after the failure of the Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. U.S. Federal Reserve officials raised the benchmark lending rate by a quarter of a percentage point, the ninth rate hike in a row. CNBC has also covered this story and tells us more. According to the minutes from the U.S. Federal Reserve's most recent two-day monetary policy meeting, some participants noted that given persistently high inflation and the strength of the recent economic data, they would have considered a half a percentage point increase in the target range to have been appropriate at this meeting in the absence of the recent developments in the banking sector. Given those projections and their own economic uncertainty, policymakers judged it prudent to increase the target range by a smaller increment at this meeting. Policymakers also claimed that actions taken by the U.S. Federal Reserve and other government agencies to mitigate possible contagion and secure the U.S. financial system had quelled immediate fears and calmed conditions in the banking sector. Because of that, they said, they thought it was appropriate to address strong economic data and sticky inflation rates by raising interest rates by a quarter of a percentage point instead of pausing altogether. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell said at a news conference following the conclusion of the March policymaking meeting, "While bank failures can erode confidence in the banking industry, they can make borrowing harder, which can also curb spending and ease some pressure on prices and the labor market." Claiming that the banking industry remained sound, Jerome Powell said, "Such a tightening in financial conditions would work in the same direction as rate tightening." Silicon Valley Bank's collapse was the second largest bank failure in U.S. history and underpins the worst banking crisis since the Great Recession. The bank, which had over $200 billion in total assets at the end of last year, primarily provided banking services to venture-backed technology companies. The turbulence in the technology industry meant many customers were burning through cash and taking out their money at a faster pace. Signature Bank was the other casualty of the U.S. banking industry's recent turmoil, and later, Swiss banking giant Credit Suisse, which was forced to merge with its longtime rival, UBS, as a remedy. Reuters news agency has also covered this story and tells us more. Deposits at three United States financial institutions fell in the first quarter as the industry's biggest crisis in more than 10 years prompted a flight of funds, with customers seeking better returns elsewhere. Deposits at custodian bank State Street Corp and regional bank M&T Bank Corp fell by 3% each, while those at Charles Schwab Corporation shrank by 11% from the prior quarter. State Street stock plunged by 11%, dragging down its peers Northern Trust Corp and Bank of New York Mellon Corp. Shares of brokerages and financial advisory firm Schwab were up 2.8% in afternoon trading, and M&T Bank shares were up 7%. The results mark a mixed start to a busy week during which a number of U.S. regional lenders are expected to report earnings and the impact of the crumbling of the two banks in the country recently. Investors will also be passing executive commentary for details on the economic impact of the Federal Reserve's quantitative tightening, which has boosted the income earned via lending, but has at the same time given rise to uncertainty. Both Schwab and M&T Bank rode a surge in interest income to beat profit expectations, but State Street fell short after an outflow of client funds hurt its fees. Credit Suisse analyst Susan Katzker wrote in a research note that the State Street's earnings fell short of estimates due to lower-than-expected net interest income. Susan Katzker wrote, the firm showed heavier outflows from non-interest-bearing accounts. U.S. Federal Reserve data released on Friday, 14th of April, showed deposits at all commercial banks in the country rose to $17.43 trillion in the week ending 5th of April, an increase that was generally evenly shared between the largest 25 banks as well as the small and mid-sized banks. That left deposits at the largest banks above the levels before the collapse of the Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. Deposits at small banks were still short of their previous levels. Schwab, which was caught up in the recent crisis, paused stock buybacks but moved to allay concerns about its financial strength. Its chief executive officer, Walter Bettinger, addressed commentary about portfolios of debt securities held by banks, including Schwab, which are disclosed as unrealized losses in their earnings. Fitch senior director Bain Rumor said Schwab's net revenue may be modestly pressured throughout 2023 as higher cost funding sources weigh on net interest income, but the firm's size and scale should support profit margins at levels consistent with historical levels.
Food for thought.
Salam, and since we are still basking in the blessings of Eid al-Fitr, following the end of the fasting month of Ramadan, here is food for thought from the Commander of the Faithful, Imam of the Pious, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, the divinely designated vicegerent of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Indeed, the Eid is for those whose fasting has been accepted by God and whose worship has been appreciated. And any day on which God has not been disobeyed is Eid. Thank you.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the trust in Allah. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of the trust in Allah in the Islamic lifestyle. It is necessary that when we talk about the ethic and the training perspective of our children, to having the Islamic training of our children, we teach them to trust in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This trust in Allah is very important, because when we know that our children are trusting upon us, and whatever we say, they do. Whatever we give them to eat, their clothing, their living, even obviously in one house when they are with us, they feel safe. They trust us. Similarly, we need to build this trust between them and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And it is the duty of the parents to teach their kids how to trust Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. One of the reasons why it is important to have trust in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is that because in the Quran chapter 5th verse 23, Allah said, وَعَلَى اللَّهِ فَتَوَكَّلُوا إِن كُنْتُم مُؤْمِنِينَ. And upon Allah, therefore, you all trust if you are the believers. Means that Quran says that the signs of the true believers is that they trust in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Which means that, in other words, if someone does not trust in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it means that he is not a true believer. Therefore, when we want our children to be the true believers, then they must trust on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and we need to teach them and tell them about its importance, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the trust in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We said that it is necessary that we need to trust, because we need to teach this to our kids if we want our kids to be a true believer, if we want our generations to be the mu'mineen and to have an Islamic lifestyle. When we talk about the trust, obviously the first question that pops up in the mind is that what is the definition of the trust? According to Shahid Murtada Mutahhari, one of the scholars, great scholars, Shahid Mutahhari, he says that the trust means that a man or the human performs the thing that is true, and he performs which is right. And in this thing, he trusts in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that he is the support for him. Obviously, he provides the support. He is at his back. And he is just performing the right thing which he has to do. And the right thing should be done by the mu'min without any hesitation, without any fear, and trusting on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, knowing that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is supporting him because he is obeying his commands. And that's why the tawakkul itself is the security that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is always with us. He is always supporting us. He is at our back. He is supporting us. And when we have Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when we have the most powerful entity, then there is no fear of anyone. Then we should not have the fear of anything or anyone, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
World.
Part 2.
Alarming observation being recognized even more widely by the scientific community. The scientific community, but also legal community. Several judgments have been rendered in favor of people suffering from waves. In Toulouse, a court grants a disability pension to a woman recognized as electrohypersensitive. In Grenoble, a court orders removal of a new generation water meter connected to the house of a person who is also electrohypersensitive. And in Brescia, Italy, the Court of Cassation enforces payment of a disability pension to Innocente Marcolini, a business executive who acquired a tumor due to intensive cell phone use. Marcolini spent 6 hours a day on the phone. He developed an acoustic neuroma in the left ear. That is a benign tumor that had to be removed. He has the operation, but is not unscathed by it. Unable to work, he fought in court for a disability pension. The court ruled in his favor. This recognition by the court is a first. Marcolini received a disability pension of 80%, but today remains on the sidelines. In 2011, the International Cancer Research Center, an agency of WHO, classified electromagnetic fields from mobile, wireless, and Wi-Fi telephony as possible carcinogenic. One of the most recent cancer studies was sponsored by the American government through its National Toxicology Program. The goal? To study rats and mice subjected to mobile telephony radiation over a continuous 2-year period. We contacted Ron Melnick, the person who designed the research program. He responded to our questions from Connecticut.
We tested the null hypothesis being that there would not be a biological effect. The results from this say that we can now dismiss the null hypothesis because effects have been observed. The most important are that there were increases in brain tumors, gliomas, and increases in schwannomas of the heart. Schwannoma is the tissue of the nerve sheath, and these were found in the heart. There was also DNA damage observed in the brain cells of rats and mice. And the importance of this finding is its consistency with what has been reported for humans.
Would you say today that using a cell phone is dangerous?
I would say be cautious on how you use a cell phone. Children should be limited in the amount of use that they have of a cell phone, especially since the radiation can penetrate deeper and more intense in a child's brain, and a child's developing brain is more sensitive to an agent. My advice would be cautious about it, take a precautionary measure, use speaker sets on cell phones, use headsets, text, except when driving, but try to keep the antenna away from the body.
Highlighting the risk of cancers confirms results from other human studies in Europe, studies concerning the advent of tumors and intensive telephone use. However, there are still many skeptics.
I don't think anyone wants to believe that what they are holding in their hand has a potential cancer risk. But right now, the scientific evidence is accumulating in the direction that there is a health risk.
Results of the study are still incomplete, but the American Toxicology Program made them public due to their significance. The final report is due in late 2017. One point has unanimity. Children are more vulnerable than adults to electromagnetic radiation. In France, a law forbids Wi-Fi in nurseries, but in Switzerland, things are not clear on the subject. Sonia and Karine both have three-year-old children in a private Geneva school with broad-based Wi-Fi with near 4G frequency, and they are fighting to replace Wi-Fi with a cable connection. The woman wouldn't disclose the name of their children's school. As concerns connectivity, the private foreshadows the general use of digital announced in public education. The Moser School accepts students after age 8, but in its classrooms, Wi-Fi is present and children all have a tablet, which allows them to do online exercises. But can we really be confident? In 2006, Basel and Bern universities analyzed 60-some studies on the dangers of cell phones. Researchers' discovery: studies financed by the industry observe negative health effects in 33% of cases. Publicly financed studies observe negative effects in 82% of cases. Conclusion: results vary depending on the financing, casting doubt on researcher independence. In the Strasbourg Parliament, Green Deputy and PhD in biology, Michel Rivasi, denounces the phenomenon. Rivasi is fighting to create wave-free zones with no electromagnetic radiation. Switzerland has none except for this little building near Zurich. 20 people live here who are hypersensitive to waves, to chemicals and other pollutants. A building born of a long struggle led by Christian Schifferl. This building is unique in Europe. Cooperatively managed, it meets all the needs of a normal life for hypersensitive people. Like many hypersensitive to waves, Christian Schifferl is also sensitive to chemical products and must often take shelter inside to avoid breathing perfume or detergent odors from visitors. But as for radiation, he feels safe. Conventional buildings, however, are permeable to electromagnetic fields. Our houses are rife with appliances whose radiation penetrates walls.
So, some wants to know what to expect. Pierre de Boucher visits the Breda family to provide an update on the intensity of their exposure. With his analyzer, the engineer measures low-frequency fields emitted by appliances and high-frequency from the telephone and Wi-Fi. First test with the microwave oven. Next, the turn of the little Bluetooth speaker. And then the induction cooking range, which emits low frequencies. Other advice from the engineer: turn off the Wi-Fi at night and put cell phones on airplane mode while sleeping. Disconnected, they still work as an alarm clock. These precautionary measures Sustine Berger didn't use until 2011, the year he became intolerant to electromagnetic fields. Since, this mechanical engineer had to learn to adapt. He invested tens of thousands of francs to protect himself. Shields on windows, carbon insulating paint on walls, insulating electrical circuits. All to protect himself from radiation. His house is healthy, like an island in a world that feels more and more hostile. As for Lynn and Mary Lou, they learned to limit exposure due to their father's problem. Being hypersensitive in a world connected and growing fast is to be resigned to living on the margin. At the dawn of the 5G era, which will require even more powerful transmission capacity, warnings from the scientific community is even more precise. Some will judge this caution as excessive, but it's more difficult to ignore the effects imputable to this technology. What price are we willing to pay to continue to benefit?
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Disguised as Palestinians, Israeli regime forces infiltrate neighborhoods when they are most crowded and turn them into battlefields. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Middle East Eye wrote in this regard, on March 16th, a similar raid was conducted in the West Bank city of Jenin, although with some variations. On a busy Thursday afternoon, on Abu Bakr Street, where Jenin Central Market is usually crowded before the weekend, four gunmen alighted from a vehicle and opened fire at the crowd of shoppers and pedestrians as they targeted two Palestinian resistance fighters. The two men, identified as Nidal Khazem, 28, and Youssef Sharem, 29, had left the Jenin camp that day where they had been in hiding to visit a barber shop and a sweet shop in the city. They were on a motorcycle when they were killed, along with two others, including a 16-year-old boy. 23 others were also wounded in the raid, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. Sara Abu Al-Rob, who was leaving a dental clinic when the incident occurred, said, "Everyone was screaming and crying and running everywhere. Women and children were terrified, while men were trying to protect us and get us inside the shops to avoid being shot. I decided to go back to the clinic. I thought that maybe it would be safer than the street, but the clinic's window was directly overlooking the roof of the opposite building, where resistance fighters hid behind water tanks and clashed with the special forces. Abu Arab and other patients in the clinic took shelter from the shooting in one of the corridors. Before visiting the clinic, Abu Arab had met with friends she had not seen in 7 months. She recalled, "We walked in the city's neighborhoods and talked about how much we love it and about the intimacy we feel being in it. But this intimacy vanished in the blink of an eye and turned into fear and horror. When the shooting started, I tried to reach out to my friends to make sure they were okay, but I could not. Military raids are nothing new to the Palestinian people, but they are usually conducted on the outskirts of cities and neighborhoods. What made it horrific that time was the fact that it occurred in the middle of an overly crowded market." Following the incident, Abu Arab said in a Facebook post, "This is a scene that we do not get used to, no matter how many times it occurs. These grieving voices do not disappear with time. This huge loss does not fade with time. Rather, they generate fear, hatred, long revenge, and perhaps a little hope." As soon as a raid begins, Muhammad Ordonia, a football coach and photographer, puts on his paramedic suit and rushes to the field to treat the wounded. In such events, Ordonia says that he and his fellow paramedics forget the fear as their first concern and priority becomes saving lives. The 28-year-old paramedic and several of his colleagues, who were part of a medical relief team of 25, were present in Bab al-Saha area in Nablus the day of the February 22nd raid. Ordonia told Middle East Eye, "We had been dispersed across multiple areas to ensure that we could respond to any injury cases throughout the areas of clashes. We treated a large number of wounds caused by live bullets, rubber bullets, and tear gas canisters." Ordonia said that during military raids, the Zionist regime forces do not differentiate between paramedics, civilians, and resistance fighters. He added, "You're a Palestinian, you're a target. Paramedics are always in the occupation banks of targets." His fellow paramedic Hamza Abu Hajar was seriously wounded in the liver and spleen while he was trying to treat a wounded Palestinian in December. Ordonia said, "I do not stop thinking of what would happen if I were to be in his place one day. But once we received the call to save the wounded, and the moment I wear my paramedic suit, I perform ablution and pray. Then I rush to the field. At that moment, the thoughts stop, and I forget about death. In many cases, ambulances are targeted by Israeli regime gunfire or prevented from evacuating the wounded and reaching the hospitals." Nawal Abu Sui, a public relations officer at Ibn Sina Hospital adjacent to Jenin Camp, said, "Many of the wounded arrive in private cars rather than ambulances. In such events, the youth of the camp, who also resist the occupation, work as paramedics." A Away from street battles, a different type of battlefield takes place in hospitals during the raids. Abu Sui said, as soon as the raid begins, the hospital near the scene of the incident prepares to receive the wounded. Doctors from all departments are called upon to ensure that they are fully equipped to receive and treat all injuries, working tirelessly to save lives. The emergency rooms become crowded with victims and their families who rush to the hospitals to see whether their sons are among the victims and whether they're alive. The wounded arrive one after another, leaving doctors exhausted in their attempts to save those who are seriously wounded. Their voices can be heard echoing throughout the hospital, calling for blood donations or asking nurses to transfer the wounded to operating rooms or intensive care units. Abu Sui recalled, relatives of the wounded wait in the emergency department, not knowing if their fathers, brothers, or sons would survive. But the harshest scene I have experienced was when I comforted a mother of a seriously wounded young man, telling her that he was going to survive, only to know 10 minutes later that he had passed away. There are only a few moments between the hope of survival and the fear of loss. Last year, Abu Sui took part in shrouding Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Aghla after she was assassinated by Zionist regime forces, an experience she still cannot believe she had lived through. "It was shocked by what happened, and I was shrouding her. I still could not believe it. Everyone who saw me that day told me that I appeared to be unwell." A few hours after each military raid and after the special forces retreat, doctors continue to perform their utmost to save the wounded, while the dead are mourned and buried. The entire city usually falls into a state of deep grief, and shops close down as most West Bank cities observe a general strike. Military funerals are held for resistance fighters who are killed during clashes with the Zionist regime forces to honor their struggle against the occupation, and the scores of residents go to the streets to attend funerals, chanting for Palestine and the victims, and threatening the Israeli regime occupation with retaliation. Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we look at a trending news story which has a direct relevance to the beautiful religion of Islam, and we break it down from a Muslim perspective. A spat of Islamophobic attacks in the UK's second largest city, Birmingham, has put the spotlight once again on anti-Muslim racism in Britain. Official statistics show that Muslims are the most targeted group in this country, with nearly 3,500 hate crimes perpetrated against Muslims in England and Wales last year. So on today's show, we're going to ask why Islamophobia is reaching epidemic proportions and what can be done about it.
On the 29th of March, around 11 p.m., an elderly Muslim man walking home from his local masjid was viciously attacked by three men. The unprovoked assault left the 73-year-old victim hospitalized with a broken hand and multiple cuts to the face. The incident is just the latest example of an all-too-common event in